Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth on what makes a state a battleground. Not that our votes up here in the Midwest or out there in the plains or on the Pacific coast don't matter. Of course they do. But there are a handful of states that will tell the tale today why that is and what those voters reveal about who America is. We're starting in Pennsylvania, and our guest is Tom Fitzgerald. He's political writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Tom, I hear you got caught up in that Philadelphia transit strike, and you're in New Jersey this morning. Is that right?
That's right. The traffic is horrible in Center City, Philadelphia. So I live over here, and it was easier to get to the office on this side of the river.
Good to have you with us, wherever you're from. I'm puzzled, Tom, as to why Pennsylvania has ended up as a swing state. It's gone Democratic since 1992, hasn't it?
It has. We're sort of in the quadrennial phase where there's a little window in which Republicans see the possibility of winning Pennsylvania, and then there's a whole lot of money spent and a frenzy of candidate visits, and then the Democrat wins. That's the pattern. Of course, you know, maybe this will be the time that's different. We went through this with Mitt Romney 4 years ago. He was drawing crowds of 30,000. Mitt Romney.
Right.
You know, that's something. And in the outskirts of Philadelphia, and things seem to be closing fast. But then in the end, President Obama carried the state by 5 points. So I don't know, Republicans talk about, the situation with Pennsylvania is like Lucy holding the football for Charlie Brown and that famous, and then yanking it away at the last moment.
Well, do you think the reason that Republicans are hopeful every 4 years is because, and this happens, I know, in a number of other states, but there are like two or three Pennsylvanias. Who the voter is in Philly is probably not a lot like the voter might be in Carlisle or, some of the other cities of Pennsylvania. Is that why Republicans think, hey, there's fertile ground there, we can make progress there?
Absolutely. I mean, there might even be more than three, but, there's the central rural part where Carlisle is. There's northeastern Pennsylvania, the old anthracite coal country around Scranton, and there's coal mining areas and hollowed out manufacturing towns in the southwest by Pittsburgh, and there's an awful. Pennsylvania has a very one of the biggest markers in this election for Trump support has been educational level,
right,
and race, and so white folks without college degrees are his biggest backers in general. And Pennsylvania has a smaller percentage of white people above age 25 with bachelor's degrees or better. So it's kind of fertile ground anyway, and we have had the deindustrialization phenomenon in parts of our state, and a lot of suffering and resentment since NAFTA, another free trade. In other words, it's fertile seeming ground for a Trump message.
Yeah.
The problem for him is the Philadelphia suburbs,
right,
and particularly women.
Well, so this is what I want to ask you about, Tom. So Western Pennsylvania is this area of the state that's leaning harder to the right. But even as maybe that area leans to the right, you have all these people that live in Philadelphia and live in the suburbs around Philadelphia that sound like they cancel out what's happening or they diminish, they mute the impact of what's going on in Western Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Carrie, mute the impact is a great phrase for it. That's exactly what happens. And it's far more populous out here. I suppose if you put the four counties outside of Philadelphia and the city together, about a third of statewide votes are cast there. And President Obama, for instance, when he won by 5 points 4 years ago, he only carried 12 counties. I mean,
wow.
there were the five, and then up around in the Lehigh Valley, the Allentown area, and Allegheny, where Pittsburgh is, Center, where Pennsylvania State University is, and Erie, I believe. I may be missing a couple, but you know, that's where the population is, and the rest of the state was Mitt Romney red. It's like those, you know, if your listeners have seen those maps that look at political opinion by county level across the country, where you know, there are little specks of blue, like like Ramsey County and Hennepin County, and then red all through, you know, until you get to like Washington and California and Oregon, you know.
I think that's a good point. When you look at the Electoral College map, even, you see this big, wide expanse of red in the middle of the country, and then the blue kind of on the outside. The trouble for Republicans is often that big expanse of red includes a lot of states that don't have high populations, like the Dakotas,
exactly.
Like Idaho, you know, like some of those other states. I mean, there are Texases in there that make up for some of that. But you're saying that's how the county map would look in Pennsylvania.
Exactly. Precisely the western Pennsylvania that you're talking about is very real, very real Trump country. But it's been losing population, and the population has been shifting into these more urbanized counties
Tom,
in Pennsylvania.
Tom Fitzgerald is with us. He's a political writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer and one of our guests to talk to us today in battleground states. What's going on in places like Pennsylvania and Ohio and Florida? We're going to check in with reporters there, talk about why these states demographically end up being battleground states. And we're kind of getting some insight on that from Tom. When Pennsylvania hasn't gone Republican since 1992, and yet Republicans pour a lot of money and time into Pennsylvania. And so we're taking a look at the demography, the voting profile of Pennsylvania to say why it is that Republicans often think that it is within their reach. Another question here, Tom, on that. Pennsylvania has a population that's older than a lot of other states. I think I was reading that the average age is 40.7. Now, that ought to be good news for someone like Donald Trump.
Yes, it ought to be. And it sure it is to some extent, although, you know, education levels have sort of divided people more than age. But yeah, older voters tend to be more conservative. And Pennsylvania is a real settled state. I believe it's third oldest. Florida and West Virginia, I think, are ahead of it in terms of average age and people over 65. So yeah, that should be helping him too. But he doesn't do as well in the Philadelphia area where the people are, even among those 65 or over. Now, today, in fact, Melania Trump is being sent to the Philadelphia suburbs to try to charm, to boost up his standing among women, supposedly.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know how that works, but we'll see.
Tom, how's the Senate race between the incumbent Pat Toomey and his challenger affecting the presidential race? Is it going to have an effect on turnout, do you think?
Like reverse coattails? The presidential race have an effect on turnout, or the
no.
Senate race?
No, I mean, yeah, potentially that there's high interest in a hard-fought Senate race, and might that have some effect on who comes out for the presidential race? Yeah, it is kind of a reverse coattails.
Yeah, you know, and I've been in Ohio a lot, and you can talk. I mean, you have someone from Ohio coming out.
We do.
They'll know better, but there
yeah.
is that's really happening with that race there, and it is to a lesser extent here. It's pretty hard fought. The Democrat Katie McGinty is ahead by about an average of about 3 percentage points, and so she's considering that Hillary Clinton has a more substantial lead here. She's underperforming, meaning the Republican incumbent Pat Toomey is doing pretty well, and so yeah, so it's possible that. That generates some more Republican turnout. It helps generate turnout for them. Now, but because one problem for Trump is he's never had the chance to or really been able to build a get-out-the-vote organization,
Tom,
unlike the Democratic side.
Tom, one last question for
sure.
You. Where in the state are you going to particularly be looking for turnout? I mean, as the votes start to come in on election night, what are you going to be watching?
I'll be watching southwestern Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I'll be watching Philadelphia itself pretty closely for African American turnout. There, Hillary Clinton, about the only way she could really lose the state, although I hesitate to make predictions this year, would be if there was a collapse in African American turnout, and of course, as you know, there's been concern about that because the first African American president isn't on the ballot anymore, so people are wondering if there'll be like a diminishment of turnout in the city.
But so you'll be looking for what is the turnout for voters of color look like in Philadelphia and what's happening in western Pennsylvania?
Exactly.
Okay.
For that, I'll be trying to weigh what that balance is shaping up to be, the balance you mentioned. That'll sort of tell the tale, I think.
I appreciate the insight, Tom. Thanks very much.
Oh, my pleasure, Carrie.
Tom Fitzgerald is a political writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We're dropping in on three battleground states this hour to hear how voters are viewing the presidential race and what the demography of these states say about who the American electorate is and the issues that they're thinking about and the way they might be thinking about turnout. Now to Ohio, a place that has not only been consumed by the race for president and for a U.S. Senate seat, but also the battle against the Cubs for the World Series. And we know how that turned out. Jeremy Fugelberg is with us, a staff writer at Cincinnati.com. Was that salt in the wound, Jeremy? I'm sorry.
No, for some people. I'm actually a Minnesota Twins fan. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah,
are you really?
It wasn't terrible for me, but there are a lot of friends I had in the newsroom who are fans of both teams, and so very mixed emotions today.
I want to bring something up that our reporter in Pennsylvania just brought up, which is what's happening with turnout and a hard-fought Senate race and how that might affect turnout in Ohio, which is kind of, as Tom put it, the reverse coattail situation. Is that happening mm-hmm. in your state?
It's hard to say right now. I mean, we're certainly looking at a different type of situation for Senate. The polls have Republican Rob Portman quite a ways above Democrat Ted Strickland here. But Portland does have a lot of support. And I think there were a lot of Republicans on the ground who were hoping that there would be some of that reverse coattail action. Turnout could be a question if people are voting just for Portman, especially with the sizable lead he already has.
Jeremy, tell me what it is about Ohio's demographic makeup and the geographic makeup that creates this perennial swing state status for Ohio. I mean, what is it?
Well, Ohio, we're very proud of this, being not just a swing state, but a bellwether for the rest of the country. And you've got quite a mix. I mean, you've got a very diverse state to a degree, although that's changing, and we should probably talk about that. But also very mixed types of economies as far as big industries, agriculture, manufacturing. It's just quite a wide range. And so, up until probably relatively recently, it was very reflective of America, which is why you'd always hear the, as Ohio goes, so goes the nation. And that may be less true now than before.
What? Tell me a little bit about what you're thinking about when you mention the demographic change. And where is it happening in the state of Ohio?
Well, just the state as a whole, you're not seeing the same kind of diversity that you're seeing. America's changing in ways that Ohio is not. So you certainly have a lower percentage of Hispanic population here, say, than other parts of the country or the country as a whole. It's becoming a whiter state. In this campaign, a big factor has been less educated white male voters make up a larger part of the population here than some states. So you're seeing Ohio as a swing state move in a different direction than some other swing states because you have a stronger population that's holding tough for Donald Trump.
This is really interesting to hear you say that against the demographic tide that's happening in so many states, even states like ours in Minnesota and Wisconsin, Ohio is becoming whiter. I mean, is that about industry? Is that about, you know, population centers of immigrants? Why is that?
You're not seeing the. I mean, you've got a lot of industries in Ohio that took major hits before and during and coming out of the Great Recession. So it's the economy here is certainly stabilized, although you certainly have pockets of places where it's very tough economically. But you're looking at job centers that just don't attract people from outside the state like perhaps they did in the past. So it's not necessarily that you're having a big influx of white people, for example.
Uh-huh.
You're not attracting the same kind of diversity because the jobs just aren't what they used to be. Although there's certainly jobs to be had here, but it's changing.
Hasn't Cleveland been trying to kind of remake itself as, you know, when I hear about what leaders in Cleveland are talking about, I think about, you know, that's what Minneapolis leaders were trying to do 20 years ago to a large part. They were successful, you know, more kind of creative sort of economy jobs to attract people to.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, you're seeing that in cities, Rust Belt and otherwise, all over Ohio, who are trying to remake themselves from say, more of a blue-collar type situation to something where you are looking at more creative jobs and more, you know, even hoping for more diversity to grow in these urban areas. And you have mixed results there. You know, Cleveland would certainly hold itself up as a success story, and there's certainly a lot of good things that have happened there, same in Cincinnati and same in other cities, but that's not true everywhere. And it's, it takes time, and this is still early in the process for some of Ohio cities.
So, Jeremy, for Democrats to win Ohio, they need to run up big margins in the cities, right, in Cleveland, right? So in the state, where do Republicans look to for big caches of votes?
Everywhere else.
Okay.
is really, really where they're hoping. I mean, suburban areas, for example, outside Cincinnati, proper, you have some surroundings, some sort of ring counties, I guess you could call them, and they're heavily Republican. And Republicans are really counting on those counties to turn out in strong numbers. And, of course, also hoping that in the urban areas, the African-American turnout isn't what it has been in the past. And there's some indication that may be true, although that's hard to see in Ohio right now for sure.
Why?
Because it's apples and oranges. We lost a week of early voting, it's tough to compare this election to previous elections. And also the way Ohio does, it doesn't really do voter registration. It's more of looking at how you voted in the past. So that's no, especially in this election, that's no hard guarantee that, you know, someone who looks to have been a Democrat may be voting Democrat in an early ballot. So it's an apples and oranges comparison.
Would you say that there's a sense that this is a kind of personality driven choice for Ohio voters as opposed to strictly policy? And I know voters, when you ask them what they're voting on, they'll often say, well, it's about the economy or it's about health care. But this election has been so unusual. I'm curious about if you really scratch beneath the surface of what's going to bring Ohio voters to a specific candidate, what it is. What's your sense of that?
It varies a lot, but you certainly do. And maybe not as much personality as it is emotion. I mean, you have there have been parts of the state that I've been in where it's they're less, you know, interested in the minute details of Donald Trump's economic plan. But when he talks about that things used to be good and now they're not, that is a powerful message for sections of the state. So, you know, the details may not matter as much in
yeah.
that case.
I was just going to ask you about that. I mean, and his plan, and you mentioned trade is also a big driver here, but the specifics of what he's going to do about that are pretty foggy, and voters don't care.
You know, I think some do. I think, you know, there are a lot of Republicans who would have supported someone like Governor John Kasich here, who, uh-huh. of course, lost, you know, won Ohio, but lost to Trump in the primary. And, you know, they're maybe looking at this and they're maybe not in the same sort of economic, and not all of them, of course, but you have many who aren't in the same sort of economic situation. And they see, you know, someone who's very, you know, Chamber of Commerce friendly Republican who's, you know, well, that's someone that we could really have gotten along with. And they see someone like Trump with this very populist, you know, bring everything back to the way things were. And that's not an economy they recognize anymore. But for a lot of people, the emotion that Trump is getting across is strong.
I wanted to ask you about Kasich and the role that he's played with Trump. As you say, he was defeated in the primaries, except in Ohio. He has, I don't know where this feud is between he and Trump at the moment, but Kasich is not campaigning with Trump, right, when he turns up in Ohio.
Far, far from it.
Okay.
He's not only stayed as far away from Trump as possible, but he's denounced him at several turns and just earlier this week said he was writing in John McCain on the ballot, which is actually just a completely wasted vote because McCain's not
right.
a write-in candidate, you know, an official write-in candidate here in Ohio. So it's that vote is purely a protest vote.
So how many Ohio voters, Jeremy, care what Kasich says he's going to do? I mean, would there be voters who say, well, if I support Kasich, and he's doing that, I can't support Trump either.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Kasich's a pretty popular governor here still. I got a note from somebody who's a big Kasich fan just the other day, and he said, you know, I've got a Kasich fan in my or a Kasich sign in my yard, and I'm hoping to keep it here through 2020. I mean, they're looking for the next round. So you have a strong base of support here, and it's not just you know, among the rank and file. The Ohio Republican Party is Kasich's party and remains. I mean, the party leaders are all Kasich people for the most part. And that's led to some difficulties between the Ohio Republican Party and the Trump campaign as they've tried to deploy in this crucial state. They you know, they'll all tell you everything's great, but all signs point to it not being the case. The Trump campaign chairman here wrote a letter really, really jumping on top of the Ohio Republican chairman for his lack of support of Trump, which, you know, he said he wasn't sure how he was going to vote until recently when he changed his mind after that letter.
Wow.
Yeah, and then just recently, now we just found out the Ohio Republican Party had an election night watch party planned, and the Trump campaign actually announced a few days later they were going to be having their own watch party about 1,000 feet away in a different hotel in downtown Columbus. So this relationship has not gone well, and it doesn't look like it's going to get any better by Election Day.
Just one last question about that. You know, Trump has not spent much money on get out the vote operations, and of course Hillary Clinton has been working on this for years, basically. So Trump's been relying on in-state Republican parties to do that for him. It sounds like he really can't rely on that in Ohio, and yet the polls seem to indicate that he's ahead.
Yeah, so it's a mixed picture in the local parties. I mean, you certainly have county chairman, and the local Trump or the state Trump chairman was praising a lot of these local Republican party chairs because you have many of them that are Trump supporters, not just in word but in deed. So you certainly do see maybe closer to the ground better support among county parties, but of course that varies quite a bit as well. But you're absolutely right. It's certainly been a different strategy. They've certainly been counting on local Republicans to carry a lot of the weight for the campaign, which those the party and, you know, the Republican, the RNC itself, which had an on the ground effort here, it was never expecting to be the sum total of the campaign. So it's been there have been very strong signs of disorganization and a lack of focused effort like you haven't seen with the Clinton campaign. But you're absolutely right. Trump's up several points in the average of state polls so far. And it looks like that base of support that he's had is holding, at least in polls. What remains to be seen is whether that equals turnout on Election Day.
Jeremy, good luck with the 5 days left and on election night. Thanks for the time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jeremy Fugelberg is a staff writer at Cincinnati.com and one of the voices from battleground states that we're hearing from this morning. We've talked to a reporter in Pennsylvania. That's a swing state. Talked to reporter Jeremy in Ohio. That's a swing state. Going on to Florida, where President Obama will be today. So you'll hear a report about that, and then we'll get some insight on why, yet again, we all may be watching Florida on election night. But to the news now, and Mike Moen. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. An Afghan police official says an assault that killed two U.S. soldiers has also left 26 civilians dead. The official says U.S. and Afghan forces conducted a raid today, killing 65 Taliban fighters, including two commanders for the insurgency. NATO had earlier said two American soldiers were killed and two were wounded in that raid. More Americans are applying for unemployment benefits. The Labor Department says claims for jobless aid rose by 7,000 last week to a seasonally adjusted 265,000, the highest since early August. Still, claims came in below 300,000 for the 87th straight week, the longest streak since 1970. In a separate report, the Labor Department says productivity of American workers rose in the July through September quarter at the fastest pace in 2 years, while labor costs slowed. A leader of an anti-European Union party in Britain says he's concerned that politicians will now try to block or delay Britain's exit from the EU. This after a court ruling that the government can't start the process for Brexit without the involvement of the country's parliament. British pound surged higher after the ruling. It's lost about a fifth of its value against the dollar since the June vote to leave the EU. And it's the end of a 108-year drought for the Chicago Cubs. They won the World Series, beating Cleveland last night in 10 innings. The game was in Cleveland, but in Chicago, fans packed bars near Wrigley Field and poured into the streets, cheering and hugging each other. Partly sunny skies in the Twin Cities, 46 degrees the current temperature. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 9:33.
This election has been great for local television and radio stations. Supply, demand, and ad space is the formula.
If you're trying to buy the 11 o'clock news in Orlando right now, good luck. You're going to need it. And it's going to be incredibly expensive. The game is, do you want to get the spot to air or don't you?
I'm Kai Rizdahl, local media swing states and this election windfall. Next time on Marketplace.
And our swing state coverage continues here in just a minute, but I want to remind you that if you can't listen to the whole in-depth conversation on politics or books or science or whatever we're talking about, you can always find it on the podcast. Right now, what are people listening to on the podcast? Glennon Doyle Melton's Love Warrior memoir and what it means to be an American, the whole series, especially that conversation I had with Eddie Gloud, a Princeton theologian. Search NPR News with Kerry Miller on iTunes.
Programming is supported by Health Partners and MakeItOkay.org, a campaign to start conversations about mental illness and stop the stigma. You can learn more about the misconceptions around mental illness at MakeItOkay.org.
I'm Kerry Miller. We're visiting three swing states this hour and getting a sense of how voters are thinking and what these states tell us about the rest of the country. We've been to Ohio and Pennsylvania. President Obama is making a final push for Hillary Clinton in Florida. Democrats are hoping Obama can help bring African-American voters to the polls. As NPR's Scott Horsley reports, that's key to a victory for her.
President Obama suggests Donald Trump's call for his supporters to monitor polling places in certain areas is a thinly veiled attempt to discourage African Americans from voting. He adds some of the groups supporting Trump don't bother to veil their intentions at all.
There are groups that are not even making secret plans. They're just out in public saying we're going to try and suppress the African American vote on Election Day.
Election Day is still 5 days away, but already there are signs that early voting by African Americans is down from 2012. In some states, like North Carolina, where Obama campaigned yesterday, Republicans deliberately tried to limit access to early voting, a move that was only partially reversed by the federal courts. But even in Florida, where opportunities for early voting have expanded over the last 4 years, black turnout is lagging in a way that could hurt Democrats. Political scientist Daniel Smith at the University of Florida says in 2012, nearly 2 out of 3 African-American voters in Florida cast their ballots before Election Day.
If the Clinton campaign is trying to wait until Tuesday, November 8th, to get out the black vote, they have some heavy lifting to do.
Obama acknowledged a black enthusiasm gap from 4 years ago in an interview this week on Tom Joyner's syndicated radio program.
Now, I know that there are a lot of people in barbershops and the beauty salons, you know, in the neighborhoods who are saying to themselves, well, you know, we love Barack. We love him. We especially love Michelle. And so, you know, it was exciting. And now we're not excited.
Obama's trying to gin up some excitement, telling Joyner's largely African-American audience he doesn't want to spend his last months in office contemplating the dismantling of everything he's done.
All the work we've done to make sure people get overtime, all the work we've done to make sure women get paid the same as men for doing the same job, all the work we've done to make sure 20 million people have health insurance.
African-Americans have seen some of the biggest gains in health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, gains that could be quickly wiped away if Trump wins the White House. Democrats can point to some encouraging signs. Daniel Smith notes African-American turnout in southeastern Florida has picked up in recent days, and turnout among Hispanic voters in the state is running ahead of the pace in 2012.
That is probably the silver lining right now for the Clinton campaign, is the high rate of Hispanic turnout, especially in the central part of the state, mostly Puerto Ricans. Polling numbers suggest that Hispanics, especially Puerto Ricans, are strongly against Donald Trump.
But Democratic margins among Hispanic voters are not as lopsided as African Americans. So it takes a big jump in Hispanic turnout to offset any decline in black voting. Obama cautions any voter who stays home out of apathy is doing the work of voter suppression groups for them. And in hard-fought states like Florida and North Carolina, even a small change in turnout can make a big difference.
Each of you could swing an entire precinct for Hillary if you vote. Or you could swing it for her if you don't vote. Your vote matters. Young people especially, your vote matters.
Obama will be making that case up and down Florida's East Coast today, and he'll be back in the central part of the state on Sunday. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Miami.
And we're turning now to Tramell Gomes. He's host of the Rotunda podcast, and he's with us from Tallahassee, Florida. Tramell, how are you keeping up with all these visits by the president and Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump? Has it been tough?
It has been tough, but exciting. As you mentioned, Donald Trump, he's also in Jacksonville, and they're probably going to crisscross with President Obama some point today.
Will you tell me what you're hearing from African-American voters about this thing that Scott Horsley was reporting on, that numbers of early turnout are down, and the president is warning that if there's apathy, you know, Donald Trump is going to win Florida. What are voters saying to you about that?
They are really taking on the message of, does my vote count? And you can pinpoint and wonder if Trump's message is working. Is the system rigged, like over and over again, looking back in history and the history of voting, and wondering whether that hard-earned vote will count. We're wondering whether it's resonating with his continued innuendos about the process being rigged. And it's very important because 13.5% of the electorate are black voters, and
wow.
Politicos are all pointing to them to really make a deciding factor. Like, them getting to turn out is what's going to make this a victory for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump.
Tramell, here's the other thing that surprised me. I read that there are nearly 3 million registered independents in Florida. And here's my question. Are they, you know, true independents? They could go either way. Or are they leaners? And Clinton and Trump both need to motivate, you know, them to lean one way or the other. Who are these independents?
Independents are people who have been, you've seen the increase to reach to that 3 million mark. That has happened over time. Each year you're seeing people are like sort of feeling disaffected and bleeding and leaving the parties, the two main parties. So they're really looking for another option and wanting to make their own decision instead of being stuck in a particular voting block. So these people are waiting, like, you know, for someone to say, hey, we're not controlled by one party. We want to make up our own mind, and we're going based on the message of the candidates. So people are disaffected, upset, and you're seeing that rise and surge into the independent party as that grow. And they usually make up their mind on their own, and it gives them a more feeling of empowerment that they're not stuck to a party. So people are looking for another option by going independent.
Do you have a sense that there is a single issue that is particularly important to these, as you say, late deciding independents?
It is just like economic issues, and those who are surging into independence or tend to be younger, looking for more options. They have like a different worldview, millennials. Things are different, not the way that they don't want to conform to the norm. So I think that's what we're seeing with the independents, and like them, not being tied to a particular issue. So it's just a wide range. I think if you ask anyone, they'll have a various amount of issues that they're particularly concerned about.
Tramell Gomes is with us from the swing state of Florida. He's a reporter and host of the Rotunda podcast with us from Tallahassee. I'm curious, Tramell, about how the race and the projected turnout is being affected by your Senate race. Marco Rubio saying he wasn't going to run, then decided to run, has been getting, I guess, a lot of help from other Republicans. How might turnout be impacted by that Senate race?
Well, this race, everyone is looking at about the down ballot, how this will impact. And the Senate race is a very close race. We have the once presidential candidate, Marco Rubio, and he had the lead early on. But now, as we get down to the wire, just 5 days out, the race has been tightened.
Really?
And we're seeing Marco Rubio really will have to sweat it out. And it's also going to be pretty much a toss-up, similar to the presidential race. And that's not uncommon here in Florida. If you look back in history, we're known for keeping it very tight and close.
We remember that. Yes, we remember that well. So if you're Marco Rubio and you're Donald Trump, which parts of the states, Tramell, are you really looking to drive up those numbers in?
Central Florida is one, and really targeting the Latino votes and the African American votes, rural areas as well. As you saw, Donald Trump, he's in Jacksonville. He was in Pensacola last night at some point. So really targeting those rural areas, hard to reach areas where there are strong, like, you know, Latino and African American population, to really trigger them and get them excited and turn out to the polls.
So do you get the sense that what we're seeing in Florida in this election cycle is an indication that Florida is as polarized as it is and as closely divided as it is, and there's no sign that's really changing? Or are we in the midst of some transition in Florida and you can see the state heading in a certain direction, you know, maybe due to demographic changes or something?
This is trying to predict and understand what has been happening in this election has thrown most everyone off course. And that's due to the Trump factor. Florida has remained consistent as being one of the true battleground states. With regards to the issues, I like going back in time. I'm trying to think back of when it's not such a close call, but we've stayed true to going down to the wire and very being a big important, like, you know, block with the 29 electoral votes. So as far as a change going forward, I don't see it. At this point, we're all wondering what will elections future look like,
right?
When
yeah.
we jump ahead with the this unprecedented election cycle that we've all gone through. What imprint will it have? How it will change things with the new voters that are out there, independents, the surge of independents, the call for a new party to break the two-party stronghold system. So the future is open, and we're all waiting to see what happens after November 9th.
Tramell, I wish you well in the 5 days till Election Day and on Election Day. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Tramell Gomes with us, host of the Rotunda podcast and giving us the read in Florida from Tallahassee. Turning now to North Carolina, where the candidates for president and their surrogates have spent lots of time, a lot of time. Dave DeWitt is with us. He's managing editor for news at WUNC in North Carolina, with us from Durham. Dave, welcome. It's good to have you on the line.
Thanks for having me. A lot of time. Absolutely.
I know.
They have been here.
More this time, Dave, than 4 years ago?
Yeah, more than 4 years ago, for sure. You know, but in 2012, both campaigns figured out fairly early on that Romney was probably going to win the state and began to send their resources elsewhere. But it is quite a bit like 2008, where President Obama did spend a lot of time here, really energized both the African-American vote and as well as the sort of new move-in vote, people who came in and registered as Democrats or unaffiliated, mm-hmm. to create sort of a coalition that turned North Carolina from a state that was solidly Republican on the presidential level into a toss-up state that he eventually won, and it was the closest race he had in any state in 2008.
You know, I'm curious about what you just said about the new move-in vote. Who are these voters? Who are these people that are moving into North Carolina?
There's a town of about 100,000 people outside of Raleigh. It's a suburb. It's called Cary, C-A-R-Y, and they call it a containment area for relocated Yankees. Mm. These are folks that are moving in from places like Ohio, Pennsylvania, other parts of the Northeast and Midwest. And they come here as moderates, mostly, maybe a little more left-leaning than the typical electorate. There are people who have grown up here who are native North Carolinians. They live in suburban areas of Raleigh, of Durham, of Charlotte, and Mecklenburg County. And these are the folks who are really determining the election here in North Carolina. This is very much an urban versus rural divide politically in this state. And the folks who are making the decision are really these suburban moms and dads who could go either way, depending on the candidate at the top of the ticket.
Well, so that's what I wanted to ask you. I mean, you said unaffiliates, mm-hmm. unaffiliated for a lot of these people. Are they true independents or are they leaners for whom President Obama, when he comes to North Carolina, as he did and says, if you don't get out to vote, you're doing the work of these groups that want to suppress voters of color? I mean, are they receptive to that kind of a message?
They can be. You know, they are more, they're more swayed by economic interests.
Okay.
They're more swayed by issues more so than specific candidates. But they are, if you follow polls in this state, and there are a lot of polls in this state, a month or 6 weeks ago, they were very much against Donald Trump. They weren't enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton. They were more enthusiastic about President Obama, and that's why he is spending so much time here trying to sort of rally that base of voters, not just African-American voters, but these sort of suburban voters who, when they come to the state, they do not register as Republicans or Democrats. They are largely registering as unaffiliated voters, because in this state, they can then choose in primaries to vote either in the Republican or Democratic primary. And then when general elections come in, we're talking about 1-2% of the electorate here, but that's all it takes in North Carolina right now to sway the election.
Dave, as with the state of Minnesota and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Ohio and some of these other places that we've been today, you know, there seem to be like two or three or more states. You've got the urban areas and then you've got rural areas, and sometimes they look quite different from one another. Is that the case in North Carolina?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know of any place in the country that's as more, defined by the urban versus rural divide. If you're driving around along with what we call the I-85 corridor, which is Raleigh, Durham, Greensboro, Winston-Salem, Charlotte, it is largely blue. It is Democratic. You see Clinton signs, a few Trump signs. If you go outside of that area in any part of the state, western or eastern North Carolina, you have a hard time finding anybody who supports Hillary Clinton. Now, the thing that makes this a little bit different is we have an African-American population here, about 25%. That's also the electorate. How motivated they tend to be to vote, as they were in 2008 and 2012, highly motivated. We're seeing some indication in early voting that maybe the African-American population is a little less inclined to vote or a little less motivated to vote. And that's why you see a lot of these surrogates coming in, and President Obama and other folks who are trying to get that particular group energized. And that's the only group that really cuts across that urban-rural divide.
Yeah, so, I mean, as you point out, Democrats are, and they're not panicking, but they're watching closely what this trend that you just mentioned, this early voting in voters of color, really means. Could there be other reasons for, you know, just a fewer African-American voters voting early who might still plan to show up on election day all the same?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of competing factors. You know, whether African-American voters are less motivated to vote or not, we're seeing some anecdotal evidence of that. But there also are some attempts, according to the NAACP in this state, of specific voter suppression. Going back a couple years ago, there was a voter ID law that passed that the federal government, a federal judge then called it, it had surgical precision in targeting African-American voters and making sure that they had trouble voting. That has been thrown out, but there are still challenges. About 7,000 voters have been challenged in North Carolina. Most of them, two-thirds, I believe, according to the NAACP, are African-American voters. That case went to the courts yesterday and is supposed to come, a decision is supposed to be handed out pretty quickly about whether those votes will be reinstated. So we see a little bit of this potential voter suppression that's happening. So most people are now wondering, is it a voter suppression and a little bit of a, you know, motivation depression issue? But whatever's happening, we're seeing a little bit fewer percentage of African-American voters voting.
Dave DeWitt is with us. He's managing editor for news at WUNC in North Carolina. North Carolina, as we've both acknowledged, has seen a lot of visits by the candidates for president and their surrogates. President Obama was there yesterday. He'll be in Florida today. Dave, we did a show not a few days ago about voter access and some of these different laws and what's happened in the 4 years since the last presidential election. Do you think with all of those, with all of that tumult that has gone on with voting in North Carolina and the court's involvement and the legislature, that there are voters who don't really understand where it stands today and have been, I guess, a bit intimidated by the process?
Oh, I think that's probably true. I don't think that's true on a wide scale.
Okay.
I think you've seen groups here like the NAACP, Reverend William Barber, who sort of exploded on the national scene during the Democratic convention. He and his groups have been really strongly reaching out to different communities, explaining to those folks what is going on and explain to them what the voting requirements are. Our State Board of Elections, in everything they've sent out, we've seen TV ads, all kinds of things, very clearly explaining that no voter ID is required because of that federal court decision. So I do believe, though, that, you know, what we saw was once the county boards of election were ordered to restore early voting sites, we did see some surgical strategic efforts to put those sites in different locations and not have them opened up early on in the process. That caused long lines, that did cause people to be waiting in those lines, and it took an hour or two and they left. Now, what happened after a couple of days was more sites than opened, and that was designed to happen. And so now those sites have been open, and they'll stay open through Saturday. But early on, the first 5 days or so of early voting, there were very few sites open, long lines, and that could have had a suppression effort for sure.
Yeah, I think we should note that you have a Republican-controlled legislature, right?
Yes, and Republican governor.
Who came in after the last presidential election to make some changes to these voter access laws, correct?
Correct. You know, the Republican legislature came in 2010, and then the voter ID law came a couple of years later. And yes, we've seen, and the boards of election, the way it works here in North Carolina, each county board of election has two Republicans and a Democrat on it because of the Republican control of the legislature and governor's office. So those groups would spend time trying to set up voter restriction, not restrictions necessarily, wouldn't call them that, but it certainly seemed like that, and advocates called them that. They set up systems that made it easier for certain people to vote and harder for other people to vote. And there were a lot of allegations that the group that were making it harder to vote were millennials, were young people, and African-Americans.
Wow. Dave, really good to have your view on this. Thanks so much. Good luck in the 5 days till Election Day and on Election Day. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Dave DeWitt, managing editor for news at WUNC in North Carolina. Now, as Dave mentioned, A lot of people have tried to vote or voted early in North Carolina. Tens of millions of Americans have already voted in key states like Colorado and Nevada and Florida. A majority are expected to cast ballots before November 8th, and analysts can detect demographic trends by looking at these early voting statistics. NPR's Renee Montagne talked to Asma Khalid about what we're already learning about those early voters.
Why are we seeing so many people voting early? I know there are a lot of changes, but what exactly are they?
Sure. You know, well, one reason, is that more states just now allow early voting. My home state of Massachusetts has instituted early voting for the first time this year. And so a lot more states are just allowing this practice, either in person or by mail-in ballot. And Renee, if you look at the 1990s, you'll see that only about 10% of voters were casting their ballots before Election Day. Now, this election cycle, we're going to see probably well over a third of Americans vote before Election Day. And if you look at some battleground states, it's even higher than that. Take Colorado or Arizona. About two-thirds of voters are likely going to vote before November 8th.
And of those a third of voters, all voters, can you tell us who they are voting for?
We can't. Election officials, aren't opening up the ballots to see how people voted. But analysts can glean a lot of details about the types of people voting. I talked to Michael McDonald about this. He's this early voting elections guru based at the University of Florida.
The earliest of early voters are people who are high information voters. They fit the characteristics of people who are paying very close attention to politics. They vote very frequently. They are registered with a political party. If there is party registration in a state, they are older than other voters.
And Renee, one important detail that you can see in this early voting data is a person's party ID.
Well, then, beyond Republican and Democratic, that is, the parties themselves, what are the demographics? Who's voting early?
So far, we've been able to see that Hispanic turnout across the board is higher than it was in 2012. And that's generally thought to benefit Hillary Clinton because she consistently polls better with Latinos. But one analyst cautioned me that some of this higher turnout, it's hard to interpret exactly what it is. He said it could just be a result of population growth. The Pew Research Center estimates that some 4 million Latinos have become eligible to vote since 2012. Then on the flip side, Renee, we're seeing that African-American turnout is down. And, there were always questions about whether Hillary Clinton could match the historic levels of turnout we saw when the country elected its first black president. And so far, there could be some troubling signs for her. And that's particularly important in a state like North Carolina. Black voters make up a large percentage of the electorate. And I asked this question to Michael Bitzer. He's a professor in North Carolina who looks at early voting stats.
Black voters are about 13% behind where they were the same day 4 years ago. And that may have a strategic campaign impact, particularly on Secretary Clinton's campaign here in North Carolina. If they don't get their coalition voters out to vote early, they have to shift their resources and attention to getting them on Tuesday, November 8th.
And Renee, one thing we should note that's very unique in North Carolina is this year there were fewer polling places open compared to 2012 where people could vote early. The other sort of wild card in North Carolina that Bitzer mentioned to me is that, we're seeing a lot of unaffiliated voters. And with those voters, we don't know whether they're voting Republican or Democrat or whether they're splitting their ticket. And we just won't know until Election Day.
That is Asma Khalid with NPR's Renee Montagne on early voting, putting a punctuation mark on our round of battleground state interviews. More political coverage, of course, coming right up to Election Day, on Election Day, and the day after.